Welcome to 5-Minute Journal Club, Oral SERDS Edition. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Since 1978, the December San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium has been the site for the first presentation of many practice-changing clinical trials, and the 2023 and 2024 meetings were no exception. In 2023, data from the INAVO 120 trial evaluating the triplet combination of the PIK3 inhibitor inavolisib combined with palbociclib and fulvestrant as first-line treatment of metastatic disease in patients with PIK3 mutations was presented. Then in 2024, the EMBER-3 trial establishing the potential role of monotherapy with the as-yet unapproved oral SERD imlunestrant in ESR1 mutant metastatic breast cancer was presented. But even more impressive from this trial was a third arm where imlunestrant was combined with a CDK4/6 inhibitor of abemaciclib. Both of these landmark data sets were presented by Dr. Kamal Jhaveri from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. I met with Dr. Jhaveri to learn more about what EMBER-3 means to clinical research and patient care, and also to obtain her take on a number of other recent SERD-related papers. To begin, she commented on EMBER-3 and the rationale for the design.
It is complex. It's almost like two trials in one, right? It was trying to address two things at the same time, which I don't know, to me, sounded like a clever thing to do, because otherwise you have to wait for another phase 3 trial and another thing to do, but also can get confusing at the same time, because, you know, it's so dynamically evolving, the space. And before we try and address a question, a new question pops up, right? You have an answer and two other questions pop up at the same time. So it's becoming so, so very dynamic. But essentially, I think just to summarize what EMBER-3 did, EMBER-3 was trying to focus on patients who've had recurrence on or within 12 months of their adjuvant therapy, which comprised about 30% of the patients. These were patients who were treated with an aromatase inhibitor with or without CDK4/6. Or they had progression for their metastatic disease, which was 60% of the patients, again, treated with an AI with or without CDK4/6, no other therapies. And they were randomized to 3 arms. It was imlunestrant alone, which is 400 milligrams orally daily, standard of care therapy. 90% got fulvestrant, which makes sense. People would choose that after AI, CDK4/6, or AI alone. And then, as an amendment, a third arm was added shortly after study had begun randomization to study imlunestrant plus abemaciclib. And the hypothesis was, if imlunestrant is better than fulvestrant, we should then study the imlunestrant plus abemaciclib combination compared to imlunestrant to see if the doublet is a better approach in these patients. Bottom line, what we learned was imlunestrant significantly improved PFS compared to standard of care endocrine therapy in ESR1 mutant tumors. The median PFS was 5.5 months compared to 3.8 months, statistically significant. We did not see statistical significance in comparison in all patients. The hazard ratio there was 0.87. It was 5.6 versus 5.7 months. Interestingly and notably, majority of the tumors that were ESR1 wild type, which was 62% of the patients, the hazard ratio was 1. So it was not inferior. It was not detrimental, but it was not statistically improved in these all patients, which was predominantly driven by the wild-type tumors, which was 62%. And then when we looked at imlunestrant plus abema versus imlunestrant, again, significantly improved PFS, 9.4 months compared to 5.5 months. And this was regardless of ESR1 mutations, because we studied that as a pre-planned subgroup. So I think that's what we learned from that study from the efficacy perspective. Overall response rates were better with imlunestrant, regardless of ESR1 mutation. It was certainly higher with the addition of abemaciclib to imlunestrant, again, regardless of ESR1 mutation. Safety profile was very, very appealing. Low discontinuation rates of 4% with monotherapy, 6% with doublet therapy. So the lowest discontinuation we have in the second line setting, and the most substantial PFS we have in the second line setting to date of 9.4 months. And in the pre-CDK pre-treated, which is 65%, are predominantly majority of our group, 9.1 months. So very attractive efficacy signal for the doublet, very good safety profile, very low discontinuation rates with only predominant grade 1 diarrhea as the important signal for the doublet. So very appealing data, I would say. 30% of these patients were those who had progression on or within 12 months of their adjuvant therapy. So that is your first-line patient population. And if you look at the forest plots, you know, when we looked at by line of therapy, was there a benefit difference? There was no benefit difference. And so really, you could have offered this therapy even in the first-line setting, which makes sense. If you're CDK4/6 naive, you should derive a benefit from a CDK4/6 inhibitor, right? And so to me, that makes sense. You can utilize that to do that. But what was really appealing to me was that this is a second study now after post-Monarch that shows you that you could use a CDK4/6 inhibitor beyond progression on a prior CDK4/6 inhibitor of palbociclib or ribociclib, both of which in the forest plot, we can see that there was a benefit seen regardless of either of these therapies. And 65% were pre-CDK inhibitor. If you recall, Capitello-291, 69% were prior CDK4/6 inhibitor, and that's our current standard. That's our contemporary patient we use. So in EMBER-3, 65% were prior CDK. And so we're saying that based on that, it seems like this is an option that is available to our patients. Interestingly, even post-Monarch, when you looked at the subgroup analyses by ESR1 and PI3K, you did see the benefit regardless of those two alterations. And everybody was like, oh, wow, that's an interesting thing. And now we see that again with EMBER-3 and the study that Hope Rugo presented with elacestrant and abema. Again, phase one study from the Electra trial. This was a pooled analysis in 42 patients looking at elacestrant plus abema. But what is really beautiful and consistent, again, benefit seen regardless of ESR1 mutation. You look at patients with ESR1 mutant tumors and wild-type tumors, the combination is better. The combination is not toxic and you can use it. So it does seem like perhaps we are comprehensively blocking the ER signaling pathway such that we are able to achieve a benefit regardless of a mutation, and we're not really relying only that ER-dependent biomarker of ESR1 when we're doing this combination. That's how I'm thinking about it in terms of why this combination might show superiority. I think predominantly the data would be applied to where it's most relevant, and I think where majority of the patients were treated, which is why I think it is mostly the second line in my mind. But certainly a CDK4/6 naive patient, if you wanted to offer this, I think it's something that you can still use. You have this data to say, yes, those were the kind of patients that were also included. And regardless of line of therapy, there was a benefit.
The next paper Dr. Jhaveri discussed focused on the phase 3 EMERALD trial, evaluating the only oral SERD currently approved elacestrant, and a subset analysis addressing the important issue of predictors of treatment benefit, in this case, the duration of prior treatment with a CDK inhibitor and endocrine therapy, identifying the one-year cutoff point as a key predictive factor.
We are trying to call the duration of CDK4/6 inhibitor a biomarker. That's how desperate we're for a biomarker. That's what this is, right? And why are we so desperate? Because there are so many complex ways that an ER-positive tumor can continue to grow, and we've not been able to find out, just ER positivity, is that enough to offer a therapy? Or is there a way for us to understand the pathway addiction and the pathway activation better? And one, you know, crude way of doing that, even predating CDK4/6 inhibitor, was how long did this patient stay on their therapy? And you would call that an endocrine sensitive tumor. If you had a patient who stays on an aromatase inhibitor, for example, as a single agent in first line setting for 4 years, compared to somebody who progressed in a year, you know that that tumor is different. It's behaving differently. And so that logic is what we applied in this setting with a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And I think right now, while our guidelines, our ESMO guidelines and ABC guidelines define primary endocrine resistance in the metastatic setting with 6 months, I think we're revisiting this definition with CDK4/6 inhibitors. And we're trying to see if 12 months might be more appropriate, which is why this paper is focusing on the 12-month mark. This analysis was trying to look at just that. Who is this patient? If they had a PI3K mutation, what would you see? If they had liver metastases, what would you expect? If they had bone-only disease, what would you expect? If they had both ESR1 and PI3K, what would you expect? Or if they had a P53 mutation, what would you expect? So I think this is just a subgroup analysis, but the duration of CDK4/6 inhibitor kind of just tells you, if you have somebody who stays on first-line CDK for a long period of time, and has an ESR1 mutation, they have the highest impact of deriving a benefit from single agent oral SERD. In this paper, as we showed, it was 8.6 months in that setting.
It didn't talk too much about benefit in people with less than 12 months and the clinical question of, is it actually worth giving in a patient who relapses less than 12 months on, you know, prior endocrine therapy? You know, you might have a patient who's older or frail or whatever, where you're just really nervous about what you want to give them. You don't want to give them chemo. Do you think it's out of the question to use it if it's 6 or 9 months?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. We know that that's a tumor that's probably not as endocrine sensitive, right? We know that maybe in the second line setting, they're not going to derive so much benefit with single agent endocrine therapy. So if I was desperate because I feel like it was an old frail patient and I had no better choices, I would try it perhaps, but I would know or expect or at least be prepared for a scenario where I'm not expecting a whole lot from single agent endocrine therapy in that setting. And be prepared, for example, to use, say, capecitabine in such a case, which hopefully will still be okay tolerated, or offer them a combination with a CDK4/6 inhibitor, given that we now also have data from the EMBER-3 trial, and hopefully that could be potentially an option. And maybe we can manage the diarrhea better with, at best, dose reduction if we had to for an older patient. But yeah, I think we would be nervous now about these tumors that are not responding on first-line therapy for a longer period of time.
The next paper I discussed with Dr. Jhaveri was another study, a poster from the December San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, addressing an interesting question related to the use of oral SERDs for a small but important subset of patients, those with hepatic dysfunction.
This is important, I think. It's really important, especially when new drugs, you know, enter clinic, because, you know, these scenarios are not necessarily entertained in the clinical trial, right? We usually exclude patients with impairments and they usually don't make the eligibility criteria. But these are the patients that we face in clinic. So we want to know if we want to utilize these data, you know, for our patients, these drugs for our patients, how do we approach these situations? And bottom line from this analysis was that, you know, when patients have moderate to severe hepatic impairments, there was an impact seen on exposures, but not to the Cmax, not to the concentration max. And so, and when we had mild impairment, they seemed like they were doing exactly the same. There was no impact on exposure or on the Cmax. But because you have this impact on exposures, maybe that might impact the dosing that we should be offering for these patients, because, you know, these exposures might lead to higher toxicities perhaps for these patients. And so, you know, fortunately, as we were saying, all of these agents, they were potent even at the lower dose, and dose reductions are permitted, unlike aromatase inhibitors and tamoxifen, where there are no dose reductions, if you will, right? Say if this drug got approved in the early stage setting and you had somebody with fatty liver with, you know, moderate hepatic impairment, at least hopefully you have an option. Instead of choosing the 400 milligram dose, you can choose the 200 milligram dose because you're anticipating higher exposure and a higher side effect profile, but you have that option. So that's what is another appealing thing about these novel agents, that even the lowest dose are attractive, so you have options for dose reductions.
We like to include at least one review article in our 5-minute journal club. And for this issue, Dr. Jhaveri commented on a great paper in Nature Reviews Clinical Oncology by Lloyd et al., providing an excellent overview of the current and future strategies of endocrine therapy of breast cancer, particularly related to the multiple mechanisms of action being studied in a variety of novel agents, but all with one central theme.
When we think about targeting the estrogen receptor, until recently, we had three different ways of doing that. We either use a serum estrogen receptor modulator, such as tamoxifen. There, we're, you know, tamoxifen is actually competing with estradiol for binding. And it's actually really modulating the estrogen receptor and then changing the transcriptional activity downstream. It's not necessarily antagonizing it. And in fact, it does this also in a tissue selective way, meaning it is really an anti-estrogen-like therapy. It's modulating it for the breast cancer, but it's actually agonistic when we think about its action in the uterus, which is why we say tamoxifen can cause uterine cancer. Another way of targeting the estrogen receptor has been with aromatase inhibitors, which we utilize for our postmenopausal women, which is really targeting the aromatase enzyme that converts the testosterone to estrogen in the body. And so we're trying to take away this estrogenic activity by targeting this aromatase enzyme. And last but not the least, we have SERDs, or serum estrogen receptor degraders, which act as ER antagonists and actually degrade the receptor, which is the case with fulvestrant. But what we have faced is that these therapies, while effective, have their own issues, their own challenges. There could be pharmacokinetic challenges. There could be toxicity challenges that we face with this. And then there are issues with endocrine resistance, mainly ESR1 mutations that can happen with aromatase inhibitors. And so there are novel, newer ways of targeting the same estrogen receptor with newer serum estrogen receptor modulators, such as lasofoxifene that are in late development, with PROTACs, which are proteolysis targeting chimera. These are like bifunctional heterodimer molecules. They target both the estrogen receptor, but they also target the E3 ligase, and together will cause degradation of the estrogen receptor. We have CERCAs, or serum estrogen receptor covalent antagonist. They really bind to a cysteine residue, change the conformation, and then change the transcriptional activity, and have activity in ESR1 mutant tumors, which is unique to them. And then CERANs, which are serum estrogen receptor antagonists. Again, idea is tamoxifen only acts on the AF2 binding domain. Can we comprehensively block it, both the AF1 and AF2 of the estrogen receptor, and with this comprehensive blockade, address this issue? What are these trying to do? Again, trying to do the same thing. Can we effectively block the estrogen receptor signaling? Can we overcome the toxicity issues? Can we overcome the resistance of ESR1 mutation-like issues and the pharmacokinetic challenges of fulvestrant? And that's what has led to the approval of elacestrant and oral SERD in ESR1 mutant tumors. And we heard data for imlunestrant, which is now published as well at the San Antonio meeting as well.
Just one follow-up question, you know, kind of with that model in mind, how would you hypothesize? I don't know whether you believe that SERDs have activity in ESR wild-type cancers. If they did have an anti-tumor effect in patients who don't have these ESR1 mutations, like how would it work?
Yeah, no, I think it's a fantastic question whether SERDs are really superior in wild-type inhibition as well. So I think any endocrine agent should have activity both in wild-type and in mutant tumors, right? When we think about these newer novel endocrine agents, they are endocrine therapy. So really, they should work for ER-positive tumors. But what has become challenging is when you have an ESR1 mutation, you know that this tumor is really specifically addicted to the estrogen receptor pathway. We know that it's using that pathway. And the way we know that is we know that it's using this ESR1 mutation. So it's a mutated receptor, but the signaling is still happening through the estrogen pathway. So it's dependent on ER, just ligand independent. But when you have a wild type tumor, there could be other actors at play. And we've not become smart enough to identify all of these factors. We have not identified a biomarker, if you will, in these wild-type tumors where we can tease this out, which is why you see the benefit with these oral SERDs and these newer agents in wild-type tumors. It's just that we've not been able to significantly show superiority when we're doing comparisons with these tumors. So there is activity, just not superiority. And because we don't have superiority, we're not getting approval for those. But if we had approval, I'm sure many patients and physicians would prefer an oral option because it's just so much more convenient. And it's not inferior, it's just that we've not shown superiority.